Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. We're recording today, Wednesday, May 25th, 2016. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. With me, of course, Abe Greenwald, our title, Abe.
Senior editor,
still. Senior editor. Now and in the past, but I can't. Just because I'm the boss doesn't mean I can remember these things. And also Noah Rothman, our something online editor, assistant online editor?
Correct.
Okay, good. So, and I'm the editor, and so you don't really need to know our titles because you're just here to listen to us. I'm going to try during this podcast to identify to the extent possible which of us is speaking that's not me so that you guys make sure you sort of can recognize everybody's voice, because this is something that radio professionals actually do. They go, Noah Rothman, blah, 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 and then after you say something, someone will say, that was Noah Rothman, Abe Greenwald, so maybe, you know, after, I guess this is our 9th or 10th podcast, and maybe
at least, yeah.
Maybe now people can, will be able to identify us by name, but
yeah.
The audience is growing every day.
It's growing.
I hope so.
In fact, that is true. The audience is growing every day. We've been incredibly heartened by the really, I think, astonishing growth from zero to, I don't know, about 20,000 people are, as far as we know, are downloading, or some of them are live streaming listening, which ups the numbers. So we're very grateful for that.
Sure. And heartening to get quoted on Twitter from the podcast.
Yes, that's always yes. Talk about a vanity induced. Talk about something yes. that really makes you feel vain and proud when totally unsolicited people, you know, start quoting you
because,
from your podcast.
Because when they quote you from an article, you see they can cut and paste. When they quote you from a podcast, they have to actually listen and type.
That's right. That was Abe Greenwald.
Yeah, there you go.
Our senior editor. And now to get to the actual topic matter of the week. Well, after a year of conservative panic, self-loathing, rage, worry, sense of doom, horror, and in some circles, thrilled excitement and the sense of party takeover and all of that, now it is the liberals' turn. I just want to tell you guys, I spent the weekend on a camping trip with people from my school. The third grade from my kid's school. I would guess that most of them are conventional Manhattan Democratic voters, and I would say that almost all of them were in a state nearing panic about the condition of Hillary's campaign, seeing the polls last week that showed Trump eking out the tiniest of leads now. I mean, in the Real Clear Politics average, he is up 0.2%. And his numbers aren't that good, by the way. I mean, it's 43 to 42.8 or something like that. It's not as though he is over 50 or that things are really so wonderful for him. Just that he, after now being the only guy in the race, is consolidating some of the Republican vote. And Hillary seems to be going backwards to some extent in that regard with the Democratic vote. So they are in a panic, and I have to say that I enjoy this a little bit with liberals and that, because there was always a sense, even though people were full of crocodile tears about how, yes, this is terrible for our republic, Trump, the lying and the deceit and the reality television, the vulgarity, how terrible, but of course that was always said with a smile, since of course it wasn't their team or their alliance or their general ideological worldview that was under threat and being destroyed from within. Well, now the shoe is on the other foot. And Noah, I'm wondering if you can diagnose why you think things are in this condition for Hillary.
Well, just to reinforce your earlier point, which I thought was pretty astute, possibly you can sort of quantify that phenomenon from, particularly in the press, with the remarkable way in which the entire media establishment has suddenly discovered this torrent of pro-Trump anti-Semitism online, which anybody on the right who's been even remotely critical of Trump over the course of the last year has been experiencing and has been drawing attention to. And then all of a sudden you have some writers for publications like the New York Times and the Washington Post who also experience this in really traumatic ways. And it's become a phenomena, a story that deserves to be examined in mainstream media outlets and discovered. And I think there's something to this. I'm not entirely sure what it is. with the perception among Beltway Acela Corridor elites who think that maybe the right sort of brought this on themselves, and they kind of deserve it a little bit.
Well, I think they did. I mean, I think what's happened is it's very palpable that liberal writers have gone from sort of looking at Trump as this deliciously deserved punishment for the right to now sort of seeing him very clearly as a threat to Hillary. Because in addition to discovering the anti-Semitic stuff, we're now seeing these essays about the rise of authoritarianism in the U.S., the potential for fascism. When meanwhile, while they viewed Trump as purely a Republican problem, it was, oh, how the Republicans should have seen this coming.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, I think, you know, they're being pretty naked about their fears. And
I would add to that, Abe, that we have been we on the right, and particularly those of us on the sort of intellectually inclined right, have been looking particularly at the degeneration of college campuses and looking at this and saying that we are sort of moving into some kind of new dark ages in which there is no free speech on campus, in which anyone who attempts to uphold standards of Western civilization or, you know, sort of proper adult conduct or anything like that comes under terrible fire. There's a very confused but very frightening essay in The New Yorker this week by Nathan Heller about the goings-on at Oberlin College, the, you know, historically one of the most liberal leftist campuses on earth, in which, you know, all these kids are saying they feel like, you know, they're under threat, and people are using the N-word to call them names, and, you know, threatening them because they have to read you know, Antigone. And Antigone, by the way, which triggers is a trigger. Antigone, Sophocles.
Yeah,
is Antigone.
No, sure, okay. Yeah.
So generally speaking, some of this fear about authoritarianism in the United States, intellectual authoritarianism, has come from our camp. And now, as you say, there is all this talk about, you know, Trump as a possible authoritarian fascist, some of which I think is extraordinarily overwrought and overdone. But some of that fear, I think, comes from an inability that, you know, the fact, yeah, that they're waking up to the notion that, well, he's just a goon, and he's just a right-wing goon, and the country is going our way. After all, look how wonderful things are, in how accepting the country is of liberal social views on gay marriage and on transgender rights and all of this. And suddenly there is this, you know, backdoor, and the demographics are all going our way. And then suddenly there is this kind of threat from the past. But, you know, it's the past, and progress is progress, and inevitably this will discredit the people that we don't like and let us, you know, march forward to a wonderful future. That's why these poll numbers are so terrifying to them, because it suggests that narrative that is in their head and the self-congratulatory narrative may not be true. And then you're seeing this week articles in the mainstream press from Gerald Seib in the Wall Street Journal and various people in the New York Times and the Washington Post saying nobody knows how to run against Trump. Hillary's got these ideas about running against Trump, and they're not going to work. I mean, Republicans tried them, and they didn't work. And running as a con man, trying to go after him like Mitt Romney, blah, 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 blah. You know, this is someone's got to come up with a way to talk about the guy. And that is just fear. That is fear manifesting itself.
Well, I agree, and I think it's coming at a particularly opportune or a particularly problematic moment for them, because I think their confidence is being rocked on the left a bit on a number of different levels for different reasons. I mean, even if you go back to the David Samuels story about and the Ben Rhodes echo chamber on the Iran deal, about there was the elite media left sort of suffered this very nasty drive-by from the White House, which boasted of how it played them for fools, and then there was sort of some pushback then from media, you know, writing now from the left, sort of starting to now criticize the Iran deal a bit. In other words, they were sort of buffeted by this sort of smooth, singular, with this one voice, things were going this one way, and now they're being rocked. And then that, in combination with then the Bernie, the Nevada the Nevada,
the violence,
Nevada camp, yeah,
the supposed violence that went on at the Nevada state convention, where Bernie Sanders supporters supposedly threw a chair at somebody, and then they were asked to leave, and then they were asked to leave the Paris Hotel in Las Vegas because they were misbehaving. And the Senator Barbara Boxer said this is disgraceful, and they booed her. And the chairman of the party and Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz said this is disgraceful, and they booed her. And this set right this idea, I think, where we go there, Noah, is that the Democratic Party is coming unglued when it should be able to walk right into the White House.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really want to diminish what happened in Nevada. It was kind of, you know, a little raucous from a bunch of true believers who are small in number, but they were very assertive. They came armed with Robert's Rules of Order. They wanted to reinstate these 63 delegates' credentials, and they went about it in a way that frustrated the process to the point where they had to turn the lights out on the guys. That's a level of organizational competence that I think you can't turn up your nose at. And then on top of that, they're also very threatening, booing to Barbara Boxer, but also leaving death threat messages on the chairman of the party in Nevada on his phone, and making a general nuisance of themselves in a way that you can't really ignore.
Well, now that's where I say, once again, I think we should take a moment to sigh and take in and have a moment of schadenfreude, because yes, we've been dealing with this on the right now for a year with Trump and the Trump supporters and punching people at rallies and horrendous behavior. But the fact is that the civil unrest and the civil decay and the attack on civility, political civility in the United States over the past 6 years has been almost entirely on the left. Occupy Wall Street, the protests at the G8. And the G20, and now, you know, at a Trump rally last night in New Mexico, setting things on fire, trying to start a riot two or three months ago at a Trump rally in Chicago. This behavior is leftist behavior. It has not been one of the reasons that the Trump behavior was so shocking. I mean, far left behavior, extremist left wing behavior, not conventional, you know, liberal behavior. One of the reasons that the Trump rally stuff has been so shocking is because it has no analog in American history on the right, you know, with the exception of a moment at the 1964 convention where some reporters felt threatened on the floor of the Cow Palace in San Francisco during the effort to nominate Barry Goldwater, which was, you know, 52 years ago.
Right, because I mean, there's a sort of understanding in conservatism that there's a sort of conservative temperament as a part of conservatism in a way that there's not, I think, on the left. There's not.
Right, and the Tea Party in 2010 and 2011 famously had these rallies on the mall. They have and then everyone stood around for 2 hours and cleaned up. They had garbage bags. It was like being a good citizen at a campsite, like me and my fellow parents of the New York City private school that my kid goes to this weekend, where everybody was panicking about Hillary. The point is that they look at Hillary and they see somebody who does not seem to have a clue how to win this election, and who is not taking it to Trump, who doesn't seem to have any success in taking it to Trump, and more importantly, is not closing Bernie Sanders down. And that's, I think, where we should go next, Noah. She is not closing Bernie Sanders down. Quite the opposite.
Well, I guess it depends on how you look at the math, right?
Forget the math. We're not talking about math.
Well, you can't forget the math, because that's their operating theory.
No, that's the mistake. That's why she's not shutting him down. She's saying the math is
over.
It's over. She only needs, 83 more delegates. There are 700 delegates will be decided. 800 delegates will be decided between California and New Jersey on June 7th, where she has leads of 10 to 15 points in each state. She's got it. It's inevitable. She's going to win. Nonetheless, Bernie Sanders is staying there saying, this is not a monarchy. She doesn't get it by right. And this is not the way it goes. And I want a recount in Kentucky. And he's going to have a rally with 15,000 people in California later this week. That's what I mean by her not shutting him down.
Well, your panicked liberal friends are not saying that they expect Bernie Sanders to burn the place down in California or take it all the way, you know, to possibly even an independent bid. They don't expect him to cleave the party in two, right? They're afraid that Hillary Clinton...
They're worried that the Democratic convention, of course, more irony, more comic irony here, that the Democratic convention in Philadelphia, which will take place the week after the Republican convention in Cleveland. We spent months saying that Republican convention in Cleveland was going to be a horror show if Trump didn't get nominated, and was going to be a horror show if he did get nominated. Now it looks like it'll probably be relatively placid, although it will probably look like the presidential speech in the movie Idiocracy. I think chances are he's going to speak four nights. He's going to have entertainment. I don't know what entertainment he's going to have. Who's he going to have? But, you know, he's going to have, like, the guy from Duck Dynasty and the third runner-up from American Idol, you know, and some tap dancer and Stacey Dash from Clueless. I don't know who else he's going to get. But it is the Democratic convention where we learned this week that Bernie Sanders has put on the platform committee, writing the Democratic Party platform. Who has he put on? Can we remember? Cornel West.
Right.
Keith Ellison, the Muslim congressman from Muslim leftist congressman from Minnesota.
James Zogby, the
head of the Arab American Institute and Washington's oldest and longest-lived anti-Israel activist. And Bill McKibben, environmental extremist par excellence. So we're going to have some fun at the Democratic convention, and fun in one category and a horror show in another, because the possibility of a Democratic platform being written that turns openly hostile to Israel and to the conduct of American foreign policy, even under Obama, that we've been so critical of, but which, you know, nominally still fits within a frame of using American forces to defend American interests, is going to come potentially under attack. While Hillary Clinton, who clearly wants to be a politician, or clearly seems directed to be a politician, who will be somewhat to Obama's right, or will move the party closer to the center than Obama had it, or that would seem to be her general indicate, will make it incredibly hard for her to do so. And so that's why they're panicked. They're panicked because they know, reading the newspaper, that there's going to be fireworks at the platform committee, that Sanders is saying democracy is messy and stuff could happen at the convention. And they're thinking, we had this in the bag. Everybody knew Trump was the candidate you were going to have the most easiest, most wonderful time running against.
And do you also think, and I don't know, but I'm putting it to both of you, do you also think that they're concerned that as this gets more bitter, that Sanders supporters will in fact back Trump at some point?
I think I don't think anybody really knows. I mean, everybody knows Sanders supporters. They're, you know, everybody on the left who has someone in their family under 30 knows everybody who's a liberal knows a Sanders supporter. Anybody who has kids on college campuses knows a Sanders supporter, or two, or five, or 10, or 20. So, I think this notion that there is a contiguity between Sanders supporters and Trump supporters is insane, and I think this is a delusion based on the notion that Sanders is getting disaffected white voters and Trump is getting disaffected white voters, right, as though the disaffected white voters in the Sanders camp, you know, aren't ideological extremists of the left, as opposed, that's who they are.
This is kind of a function of a backlash against people in the business of reading polls over the course of 2015 and 2016 who said none of this is real. What we're watching is not real. It's going to change. It's going to reverse itself. And that didn't turn out to be true in the case of Donald Trump. Donald Trump's support never dematerialized. It was pretty constant. And in retrospect, it makes sense that he would become the nominee because nobody else ever touched him, with the exception of Ben Carson very briefly. So they're looking at the polls now, and we're saying, okay, well, now we have to be totally credulous of the data. We can't accept any data point. We have to accept every data point, rather, on face value. So if Bernie Sanders supporters are going to Donald Trump, in, you know, maybe a fifth of them are going to Donald Trump, then you have to believe that absolutely, and you can't question it. If Donald Trump is eking out a very narrow lead nationally, then you have to believe that. You can't anticipate that circumstances will change, or dynamics that traditionally affect electoral politics nationally will reassert themselves. I feel like a lot of people are just sort of assuming that the data that they're seeing is going to be persistent because everybody else was so wrong for so long.
Right, that was Noah Rothman. Noah, look, here's the important point, I think. The polls show basically the Clinton and Trump aggregate and aggregate are tied. That's what they show. Trump doesn't have a 0.2% lead in an aggregation of polls is not a lead. So they're tied. And it shows that they are both extremely unpopular, right? They both have like 57, 58, 60% unpopularity ratings. Both of them are having trouble consolidating their party despite all the news stories that say that Trump is consolidating the Republicans. It's still the case that a fifth of Republicans are saying they don't want him, just as a fifth of Democrats are saying that they don't want Hillary. The danger in looking at polls and getting overly credulous is not that you can look at them in aggregate and say they're showing this. It's that when you start digging into them and trying to figure out, you know, 200 people across the country who are Bernie Sanders supporters say that they're not going to support Hillary in the fall or might support Trump in the fall, that's a tiny sample. That is like a statistically meaningless sample. It's a subsample of a subsample. And that's where you have to start wondering whether you're seeing anything that isn't just noise and that you can actually extrapolate from in the future. It's one thing to look at these polls and take the top line number. They function that way. You know, there is statistical history and, you know, sort of a record of how they work. But when you start getting into 72 people out of 500 who say they're going to do this, that's where they're problematic. By the way, this is where I think we should get to what we were talking about before.
I was just about to lead into that, because there's sort of an incongruous relationship between the national polls and the state level polls is that there is no state level poll really suggesting that Donald Trump is going to do a lot of damage to Barack Obama's states, even though, you know, you look back on, say, 2000, which was the closest national popular vote election that we have in recent times, and that's where you had George W. Bush winning states like Ohio and New Hampshire and Virginia and Florida, even though the popular vote was almost totally even. That's something you can't even imagine happening today. So, you know, whether or not Donald Trump is winning nationally doesn't suggest that the states will actually, you know, reflect those results.
Well, Abe, we have numbers. I mean, that is to say, what states – Obama got 331 electoral votes in 2012. So, you know, somehow – and Romney got 206. So if you start from there, the Republicans have to get 65 more electoral votes, basically, right? I mean – in order to win, they have to get to 271. So Pennsylvania, right?
The elusive now, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, Pennsylvania. So Clinton's up by 5 in Pennsylvania. Ohio, Clinton's up by 2 in Ohio. North Carolina, a swing state, went back and forth between 8 and 12. Hillary's up by 3.5. And then we have the weird part, which is the states that were Romney states. The truth is that right now the only threat that one sees to the 2012 math is that Hillary will take states that Romney won from Trump. Arizona, where Clinton is up by 1. I mean, if Arizona, that's 11 electoral votes. So add that to Hillary's tally and subtract that from McCain. You know, if you take that, then basically there's no hope of and Georgia, which is a, you know, which hasn't gone Democratic since Clinton in 96. Georgia, Trump is only up by 3 because it's got a very large African-American population. And the upper Midwest states, which are supposedly so potentially friendly to Trump. Wisconsin, Hillary's up by 10. You know, Michigan, Hillary's up by 11. So the idea that what we're seeing here is a potentially revolutionary election, we're going to need a lot more data that goes in Trump's direction than that he's getting 42% of the vote against Hillary's 42. She's a terrible candidate, and she is getting showing terrible polling numbers.
And this is all before the Democrats rally around her and come together. This is with them at their most divided and their most vicious.
Right. So I'm enjoying the liberal, you know, agony, but I don't take any long-term heart in it, because even though day after day there are more and more stories about Hillary's misbehavior. I mean, this morning the State Department's Inspector General's office slammed Hillary and her people for the maintenance of the private email server and said that in 2010 she had, and they had been warned that they were threatening the security of the United States by having one. It would be nice if Bernie, it would be nice from this perspective if Bernie Sanders hadn't said nobody cares about your damn emails 6 months ago, because, you know, if he needed some issue to power him between now and 2 weeks from now in California, the IG report is certainly one that he could have. Moving along to the larger perspective on the Hillary and Trump election, it began to occur to a lot of people that what we're seeing here, strikingly, is the last gasp of a true cultural conflict inside the baby boomer generation. Now, commentary, we have an article in our June issue, which you can read on our website at commentarymagazine.com by Roger L. Simon, the mystery novelist, Oscar-nominated screenwriter, creator of Pajamas Media, called Moral Narcissism and the Least Great Generation. And he basically lays out the fact that everything wrong in America is the fault of the baby boomers. I being the only person at this table between Abe and Noah, who actually might count as a baby boomer since I was born in 61, and supposedly the baby boomer generation ends in 64. But I don't count myself as a baby boomer because it's too nauseating. But Trump and Hillary, born 46, 47, baby boomer election. What's going on?
You know, something interesting. Walter Russell Mead had a piece yesterday at the American Interest. Where among the points he made was that the big protest is a kind of protest against the sort of boomer domination, the sort of boomer system that has promised a great many things, that has rewarded its own elites, but seems unable to sort of find solutions to accumulating problems. Could be true. I mean, I think the interesting thing about the long shadow of the boomers is that in talking about this, I recall that in the 2008 election, when Andrew Sullivan wrote his piece for The Atlantic about a potential Obama presidency, I think it was called Goodbye to All That, he made the point that Obama was the first post-boomer president, and he was beyond the culture wars, and he was beyond the Vietnam question. And, you know, meanwhile, fast forward 8 years later, and we dove headfirst into vicious culture wars, ramped up culture wars, questions about American, you know, military might around the globe, and all the rest of it. So I think, you know, the boomers have remade the world for their generation, our generation, and foreseeably beyond.
Well, I certainly wouldn't say we dove headfirst into it. There was a lot of resistance to this on the right and the left. And I think Bernie Sanders doesn't quite make the baby boomer generation.
He's not. He's older.
He's the silent generation, as it were.
He's older.
And you know, Mr. Mead, who's a giant intellect, you know, his suggestion here was kind of a tortured effort to say, well, you know, at least there's some modest civic health in the fact that people are noticing that things are bad and they're turning to people who are manifestly unequipped to the presidency. Right. If that's a display of civic health, I'd love to see what a sickness is. It was a noble effort, but a tortured one. And I'm not entirely sure that we have anything more than a coup going on by the baby boomer generation as they notice their influence waning and ceding to other generations their morals and their values and rejecting that in a fashion that I think, John, you actually put very well in a column for the New York Post about these two cultural clashes going on that were forged, these worldviews that were forged in the 1960s, the beginning and the tail end of the 1960s, and right. They're kind of playing themselves out on the stage today, which, by the way, doesn't speak to anybody in my generation.
Right. Well, that's the point, which is the piece that I wrote said that Hillary Clinton is a classic, what we call new class, baby boomer, you know, radicalized or left-wingized in college at Wellesley, talking about mushy hopes for a more ecstatic mode of meaning, then becoming a left-wing activist, working for the Children's Defense Fund and trying to get Nixon, impeached and all of that. Meanwhile, Trump, who is almost exactly her same age, partakes of absolutely none of that in his life. He goes off to college. There is no evidence that he, you know, had anything to do with campus activism. He graduates in 68. He goes to work for his dad's real estate company. You know, he goes to work every day in a suit. He collects rent from, you know, from poor tenants who want to throw, you know, boiling hot water on him when he knocks on the door, and is a sort of tough guy, more aligned with the working class in his mode of conduct than Hillary, than he is with the upper middle class or the upper class into which he was born. And his introduction into political life is hanging out at this kind of trashy, upscale but trashy club on the Upper East Side of New York called Le Club, where he meets Roy Cohn, the former McCarthy lawyer turned New York City, New York State fixer, who instructs him in the art of playing hardball politics, which his father, Trump's father, the Brooklyn and Queens real estate developer, had learned. He, one of the ways that he got ahead and made a lot of his money was by buying into the Democratic machine in Brooklyn and being a part owner of Abe Beame, the Brooklyn Poll, who became briefly a disastrous mayor of the city at its lowest point. So he had this instruction from his father, and then he had this instruction in unbelievably cynical, crass, low politics, how to do backroom deals, how to always be aggressive, never give in, never compromise until the very last moment and all this. And so you have these two types. They are both baby boomer types. Trump is a baby boomer type, but he is an anti-leftist baby boomer type, and she is a classic liberal leftist baby boomer type, and they are choking us to death, these people. It's enough already. Yuval Levin has written a brilliant book called The Fractured Republic, and he says that the problem with American politics, this book is just out, one of the most important pieces of sort of political analysis of the last 20 years, and he says, we are choked by a politics of nostalgia, all of which is baby boom nostalgia. Trump wants to go back. They both want to go back to the 60s in some fashion or other. Trump wants to go back to the 60s where America had 60% of the world's industrial production, and so the working class could live like the middle class. And Hillary wants to go back to the 60s in terms of, you know, sort of the how you could have both guns and butter, and no hard choices were going to have to be made about budgets and things like that. And, of course, you only have 60% of the world's industrial production in the United States, thus enriching the working class, because the other industrialized world had been destroyed in World War II and had yet to be rebuilt. And the guns and butter strategy of Lyndon Johnson led to ruinous economics for almost 20 years, wild stagflation and terrible interest rates and worldwide instability that was created in part by the need to loosen the dollar because we had been so irresponsible with it. And here we are having the same arguments. Like, let us have our own arguments already. I mean, I'm 55. I'm not 68, 69 like there, but it's time already for us to have the arguments of our own time. The Uber arguments, you know, the driverless car, what effect will the driverless car plus Uber have on the industrial productivity and the employment picture of the United States in the 21st century. We're talking still about Medicaid, and we're talking still about sort of like whether or not it was justified for the government to create Medicare. That was 52 years ago. Our political conversation is not advancing, and these candidates are choking us to death with their own tunnel vision about the past.
Well, it's not just the candidates. Donald Trump genuinely had a substantial amount of support, something to the fact of, you know, something like 40%. And it wasn't entirely demographically narrow, but it was definitely concentrated in the upper end of the spectrum of Republican voters in the age range. And Bernie Sanders represented a revolt against a sort of complacency, just allowing Hillary Clinton to coast into the nomination. But his backing of support wasn't from 70-year-olds per se, but it was predominantly a young movement, a sort of a nouveau socialism that really inspired a backlash against.
Well, fair enough. So he's talking about the present. In other words, like, I think he's talking insanely about the present, but it is because he cannot hearken back to the glory days, right, of pre-Soviet, of socialism in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. He is talking about that which has never existed, right? An egalitarian economy in which the rich and the poor are, you know, in greater equilibrium. But it doesn't, it's not the, I remember when things were so great.
Well, on the Republican side as well, the two biggest competitors to Donald Trump were in their early 40s. You had Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, who represented a very new brand of Republicanism. Neither of them were in federal office in 2010.
They weren't, but I'm not sure, to be fair. So Trump says, make America great again. Here's what we're going to do. We haven't had a trade war in a long time, so we'll have a trade war. We haven't had, you know, a really truly isolationist foreign policy, so we're going to have a truly isolationist foreign policy. We haven't had a reconfiguring of how we think about nuclear weapons, so we're going to say everybody should have nuclear weapons, right? So at least, again, he casts it in the future. I would say that part of the problem with Rubio and Cruz and Jeb and everything like that is that they were young, but they talked old. You know, they were like, you know, they were like, they were like me when I was 20 and I wanted to be 40. You know, they were trying to talk like elder statesmen. Well, they weren't talking like aggressive young men trying to get ahead and say, okay, your time is over. It's my time now. Go away. He said it. He said it about Hillary. He said it a little bit. He didn't mean it, Rubio. And that's what that in part. And by the way, I mean, some of this, these theories, like Levin's theory or the way Rubio behaved, even it's still a reaction. Like if you think that your politics is about fixing the entitlements, for example, which is something that Yuval Levin really believes and that Rubio believes, and we all understand the entitlement. If you look at the graph, that entitlements are going to eat up 80% of the federal budget by 2035 if something isn't done. But the entitlements are also policies of the past. Social Security, a creation of 1937. Medicare and Medicaid, a creation of 1965. Medicare Part D, you know, the last real addition to it is 2003. Like, this isn't about how we're going into this very complex future in which most of the structures of the economy are going to undergo a transformation that we can't even really begin to imagine. And no one can talk about it because no one understands it. Fair enough. But.
Well, and there's also always the horrifying possibility that, say, millennial politics or whatever the eventual real current and future-oriented conversation we have is more frightening than the boomer politics.
Well, that was what was really terrifying about what John just said.
That's what I was thinking.
That if the next generation, talking like a young person, as you put it, means radicalism, means tearing down institutions, means forging ahead into a bleak future just because it's new and different.
But it doesn't have to. I mean, you know, not to be sort of a techno talk and techno optimism, because I know a lot of us are semi techno Luddites here. But I mean, really think about this. Everybody that I know who works in and around tech or sort of serious about it says, okay, look, if you really imagine a world in which you have self-driving cars and Uber, that means, imagine this, like in 30 years, it really works. That means that nobody in America is going to own a car, because you're not going to have to own a car. You will literally dial up a car. It will drive you where you need to go. You'll get out, and then the next time you need a car, you'll call another one up. That means that one of the major elements of the American economy, which is supplying Americans with cars, is going to disappear. I mean, it'll restructure itself, because right, it'll be more institutional than it will be personal. And how many people in the country drive for a living?
Right.
2-3 million?
Right.
Truck drivers? Car drivers? What if in 2075 nobody has to drive a car? What are those people going to do for a living? That is an unskilled labor job that is nonetheless something by which someone can support a family.
But then you have an entire economy with a lot of more disposable income that they no longer have to put into brake pads and filling up the car.
Right.
And
that's why I say, but I'm just saying, it's not income inequality. It is, we are heading into uncharted waters all over the place. And the politics of 2015 and 2016 involve candidates who have had conversations, all of which are redolent of the past and not of the future. I don't I'm not a political consultant. I'm not a politician. I don't know how to talk about these things in a way that is. But you don't have to have Bernie Sanders is speaking to people who say it's not fair that rich people are rich. But, you know, you could have a politician who says, you know, this economy that you've grown up into in which you have apps and you do this and you, that's good, not bad. That is a positive, not a negative. That is a this is going to reorder American society in a way that is to your liking, that fits more precisely with how you've grown up and the world in which that is not a top-down world, but is a bottom-up world. And the communitarian aspects of that and the transformational aspects of that, all of that, they're very real and they are entirely absent from our general
there isn't much market for positivity on either end of the spectrum.
Well, that's absolutely right. And now you'll see that there's going to be a market for positivity because on the one hand, you're going to have this campaign, negative campaign, the most negative campaign ever, right? Hundreds of millions of dollars going at each other. But they're all going to have to talk positive while they're negative.
Well, isn't that, I mean, to me, that's sort of what Trump is this sort of twisted optimism. Because there's no sort of market for positivity anymore, it's almost as if Trump understands that we can only take our optimism if it's sort of if it comes with a big dose of
and also
with a dose of blaming and with a little fight in it. You know, it's we're gonna be winning again after we get rid of you. You know, I mean
there's only one way to win, and that's with him. So it's not even that positive in the sense that, like, if he's not there, we're not going to win again. It's not like he's not even sophisticated enough to go with the, we're going to create a rebirth of the American spirit. It's, I'm going to do these things for you. And then you'll be so happy. Mm-hmm. You're going to say, please stop winning for me, Mr. Trump. Right?
That's right.
Well, classically, politicians would say, I'm going to unleash you, and then you're not going to thank me. I'm going to thank you because you're going to make me successful because you're good, and I'm just the vessel. That was Reagan's genius, by the way, was he was the representative of the people. He wasn't the leader of the people. That's a, you know, that's a very important difference. And, of course, Trump is just Trump. That's the point. And Hillary is nothing. I don't know what Hillary is.
Well, and he's going to say that he's making America great again, sure. But it's May, and we're talking about Vince Foster, and we're talking about Troopergate, and we're talking about cattle futures.
Hey, that's the past. There's the past for you.
We're relitigating a past that really appeals to Republicans who came of age in the 1990s and remember fighting and losing these battles. And they're really excited about refighting.
I don't even know if it's Republicans who came of age in the 90s. I still think this stuff is of appeal to the Fox News audience. And do you know the age
and
of
talk
the Fox,
radio.
Do you know the age of the Fox News audience?
It's the average age? It's over 65,
isn't it? 66. That's the average, the median age. Mm-hmm. That means that as many people who watch Fox are older than 66.
Oh, and I've met them, and they are really jazzed up about refighting these battles that they think were lost.
We're not even talking about a fight. This is now Trump is fighting against Clinton from the World War II generation perspective. You're selfish. You're with harlots and, you know, you're killing people and you're a slimy guy from Arkansas. That wasn't sort of like post Cold War politics. That was an attack on Clinton from, you know, and again, remember, we're talking about Vince Foster was 1993. What year is this? It's 2016. It's almost a quarter century ago.
If you were 18 when he was killed, you'll be 41 in July.
Right. But if you were 18 when he was killed, you weren't paying attention to Vince Foster. It was people a lot older than you. When the American Spectator magazine, with which I was unfortunate, which I had a long association with and fortunately no longer do, if it still exists, when the American Spectator magazine became this like anti-Clinton, you know, crazy anti-Clinton publication in the mid-90s, the people who were reading it were themselves 45 to 50 years old. So let's date that back. They were all born in the 30s. They weren't 18. Nobody who was 18 cared about Vince Foster. Lewinsky's a different matter. But of course, you know, I mean, that's a whole other question. And again, you could talk about the cattle futures because Hillary was involved in the cattle futures. You can talk about the Whitewater because Hillary was involved in Whitewater. Trump is attempting to litigate Clinton's moral failings to attack Hillary. I think that that is a boomerang. I think the notion that the right thinks that, you know, she's complicit, and I think morally, if you're writing a novel, she's complicit. But if you think you can actually make it so that voters are going to blame Hillary because Bill stepped out on her with girls and she decided to defend her marriage instead of attacking it, I think that's nuts.
But can I return once more to the Walter Russell Mead piece, where he also drew an interesting analogy. He said, perhaps Hillary's feminism is Trump will do to Hillary's feminism what was done to John Kerry's Vietnam. In other words, so Kerry used his Vietnam experience as his one strong military tie in an age when we were at war, and the Swift boaters came along and completely negated him on that point. What if Trump now does that with Hillary and her feminism that's tied to this age?
And the problem with that is, again, I had so many problems with this piece. The problem with that is that it's talking to the left. It's talking explicitly to the left about this, the whole notion that stand by your man is no longer an admirable trait in a woman. And the underlying assertion here is that Hillary Clinton only stood by her husband because she's power hungry. And obviously, that's not going to register with anybody and say, oh my gosh, I had never thought of the fact that Hillary Clinton is a power hungry politician.
Right.
That's kind of baked in. And the assertion that you can somehow flip this idea on Hillary Clinton, that this new feminist left, which is very aggressive, is going to say, okay, we can't support her and we'll stay home or maybe even vote Trump just because she was cheated on. She determined that her career could be advanced by not making a big deal out of that or by attacking the personalities of those individual women who are accusing Bill Clinton of doing that. Well, the means sort of justify the end.
Well, the other thing, though, is, and we know this now from pieces this week from inside the Hillary campaign, that they know that the time has come to drop the I'm the first woman president, this is really a revolutionary. The people to whom that is important will know, and the people who consider that tokenism or something they don't like, or they're misogynist and they don't want a female president, will not be helpful to win them over. She's dropping it. It's not coming up again. It was a way to rally the passions of specific Democratic primary voters, and it's gone. So the notion that he can call her a feminist, but say she violated her feminism by standing by her husband, or she was this, right, or she whatever, maybe. It's all twisted. Like, this is what I mean that I don't understand. So go after the emails. Go after the current scandals. Mm-hmm. What about what about the emails in Benghazi? That's all the last two or three years. He's going back to the 90s. Why is he going back to the 90s?
Well, there's this idea that
because he's a candidate of the past. That's why. Because he's 70 years old, and he's like, like everybody else, he wants her punished for things that she did that have nothing to do with the present.
But there's also this idea that he's going back to the 90s to inform the potential voters who are too young to have lived through those things to now turn them against her on those points.
Well, I mean,
they're not, they don't care.
Or if they care, or if they're the type of people who would care, they would have voted again. They would
That's
be
right.
against her anyway.
They don't need
because
they don't
she's
need
a,
the push,
because
yes.
she's a politician of the new, you know, more liberal, libertarian, social, sexual world than he is.
And Donald Trump is also very representative of a class of political entertainers on the right who find this mode of attack very satisfying because it's a mode of attack they've been making for a very long time, myopically, and they feel like they've been abandoned because the Republicans thought it wasn't working and ditched that level, that those type of attacks on Bill Clinton. Personality, lasciviousness, corruption. They just kind of let it fade away because it was politically not yielding returns.
The
cost-benefit analysis didn't make sense. So they feel abandoned, and they feel like Donald Trump is sort of a comeuppance for those type of Republicans who chided them for their myopia.
But they're going to vote for Trump anyway. That's the problem. Like this is where the ultimate question about Trump versus Hillary is, which is they're both sitting there with 42% of the vote in these things, and someone's got to get to 50. And if he's just going to dig in the hole of the 42% that's going to get him and dig and dig and dig and dig and dig, it becomes harder and harder for him to reach out to the middle. And it's going to be easier for her. But that's why my friends, the Democrats, are so panicked, because they're worried that maybe Bernie is going to make it hard for her to reach, and that these attacks, that Trump's nastiness and you know, viciousness is in fact going to eat away at her the way it ate away at Jeb Bush. I do not believe that to be the case, because she is a gutter fighter herself. She, you know, they created this form of political combat, the Clintons, in order to save his skin. The war rooming, the, you know, going after your opponent low as opposed to high, saying they're only doing it because they're conspiratorial and raising money and they're vicious and they're evil and all that stuff. That was their creation. She knows how to play the game. You think she doesn't have stuff on Trump? She's got plenty of stuff on Trump. Plenty of it. That we haven't heard, that we haven't seen, and that is fresh. And will be better than the stupid New York Times piece about how, you know, Trump said that a girl in a bikini was cute. And that's terrible. Because that's where the idiocy of, you know, liberal politics comes in. Where the notion that, you know, it's self-evident to everybody at the New York Times that a guy saying, oh boy, you really look great in that bikini, is just the worst thing that anyone could ever say to anybody. Whereas most people in America, most people think, well, I mean, maybe it's a little crass, but she probably liked it. And in fact, she did. I believe the woman
in that anecdote. She dated him and said that she didn't mean
it. And she's really mad at the New York Times for using her anecdote. So Trump's misogyny is well documented, and that was a really, and the New York Times was so incompetent that it couldn't even attack his misogyny well. So no wonder they're panicked, is what I'm saying. They're panicked for good reason. Liberal institutions are failing them in attacking Trump in the right way. Hillary's failing them.
And not to drag this out, but back to your point that that sort of misogyny was the cool Rat Packian style of 1960s, you know, behavior patterns, whereas today it's frowned upon by virtually every cultural institution with authority and power.
Right.
And they will wield that authority and power.
And by the way, not just liberal institutions. I mean, the point is that the Rat Pack was like, hey, well, that's broad. Let's go out and have some laughs. We'll get some broads. We'll have a little laughs. Yeah, shouldn't talk too much. Don't talk so much, honey. You know, just let's sit there and look pretty. Like, that is not anything that we ourselves find anything but repugnant. And that conservative social institutions, which believe in trying to generate healthy respect for the differences between the sexes and elevate them and all of that, and, you know, and gender norms, and they don't like that either. So this that was like hipsterism of the 60s against the suffocating, you know, conformity of the 1950s, and it's gross. I mean, I love Frank Sinatra more than anybody, but, you know, if you listen to the patter, if you get a live bootleg of Sinatra at a concert in Australia or something, and you listen to the patter and how he talks about women, you don't like it. I don't care who you are. You don't have to have daughters. Everybody's got a mother, and you don't like the talk, and I'm sorry. That's just the way it is. And if you like it, sei gesund to you. So, founded in 1945, Commentary Magazine is America's most distinguished monthly of political, intellectual, and cultural affairs. Not that you would know it from this podcast today, which is not exactly, has not been the most elevated.
I thought it was fun.
It's fun, but our mission is to promote American greatness, not to talk about broads. Defend the West and its institution, not talk about broads. Represent the best that has been thought and said in writing and argument at the highest level, and stand as a bulwark against anti-Semitism and for the Jewish state. Please join our daily conversation at commentarymagazine.com. You get 8 free reads per month, and then it's just $19.99 a year for a digital subscription, $29.99 for all digital access, plus our beautiful monthly print magazine. Fantastic covers this week. We have a great June issue highlighting the horrible anti-Semitism of the Trump online following, and some other fantastic stuff. Learn more at commentarymagazine.com. Thank you for listening to the Commentary Podcast. For Abe Greenwald, Noah Rothman, I'm John Podhoretz. We'll be back next week.